Hello again, it's Graeme McKay here, and I'm back with the first of our pre-season specials of the AFC Dons cast. Hope you're keeping well. Coming up this week, all the transfer latest from Pittodrie. We'll have a quick look at the newly announced fixture list. The Dons youngsters have been performing well. We hear from Gavin Levy. And the players are back at Cormac Park for their pre-season preparations. Jim Goodwin speaks to Mal. And Jim also sat down with Graeme Hunter at the end of May. We have the full interview as we look ahead to the new campaign, summer recruitment, and much, much more. This is the AFC Dons cast pre-season update on Friday, the 17th of June. With the big transfer news first then, and Liverpool have signed Calvin Ramsey in a deal worth up to £8 million. Aberdeen will secure an initial fee of £4.5 million with a further £3.5 million of appearance and success-based add-ons. Aberdeen also hold a 20% sell-on clause. It's a deal that has substantially broken our transfer sales record. It beats the previous record set for Scott McKenna when he moved to Nottingham Forest for what was reported at the time of £3 million in September 2020. Calvin was named the Scottish Football Writer's Young Player of the Year after playing 33 times last season for the Dons and has secured three under-21 caps for Scotland. Calvin was due to travel to Liverpool this week for his medical. Dean Campbell has joined Stevenage on loan for the upcoming season. Dean spent the second half of last season on loan at Kilmarnock, with former Dons boss Derek McInnes making 8 appearances and 6 starts. His current contract with Aberdeen ends next May. Stevenage finished 21st in the English League Two table last term, 3 points above the relegation places. Aberdeen have signed midfielder Yilber Ramadani on a 3-year deal, making him the first of our summer signings. The 26-year-old, born in Germany, arrives from Hungarian side MDK Budapest for an undisclosed fee. And St Johnstone have signed Andy Considine following his departure from the Dons at the end of last season. Andrew left the Dons after a contract agreement could not be reached between himself and the club. Andy has signed on a 2-year contract with the Perth side. Meanwhile, on the rumour mill, Aberdeen have had a loan move for Sheffield Wednesday goalkeeper Cameron Dawson rejected, with St Johnstone also being knocked back as well. Having secured Ramadani from MDK Budapest, we are reportedly back into the club for a possible deal with forward Bojan Miovski. Miovski has 10 caps for North Macedonia and scored his third goal for his country in their 4-0 win over Gibraltar in the UEFA Nations League on Sunday. He has also scored 9 goals and 29 appearances for MDK last season. Conor Barron is being watched by Premier League side Brentford, according to reports. The midfielder currently has 2 years left on his contract. However, Jim Goodwin is keen to keep the player. And finally, Aberdeen have also been linked with possible target Celtic defender Liam Scales and Blackburn midfielder Jacob Davenport. We'll have all the latest transfer news on the Inverness Reds website.
More Dons news straight after this.
Aberdeen youth coach Liam McGarry was in the United States training with All Stars United. Here he is speaking about the potential to improve both clubs.
For me, it's all about trying to make a difference. When I coach in Scotland, football means so much to the players. It's part of our culture. It's part of our bone marrow, and it's amazing to have the opportunity to help young people in such a positive environment like sport. So not only is it helping them develop as young people, but it's also helping them develop as players. So for me, my two biggest passions would be people and then sport. So it's the perfect job for me.
How do you feel about it?
Hey, it's great. You know, it's amazing to be here, and it's really, really, we're really excited about this partnership, because we want to go and we want to try and support All Stars. We want to try and share ideas and try and help each other become better, both sides of the pond. So it's great to be here. But for me, I really do think it's only the start, because we've spent time yesterday in the office and I've spent time with the staff today as well. And this is my second night on the pitch. But I think this is only just the very, very beginning. So it's amazing to be here, to understand the culture of it, to understand the families, to understand the players. And that now gives us an idea of... This will now allow us to plan for the future and see what direction we're going to go.
The Aberdeen partnership has been immense for us both on and off the field, whether it's in the office doing video calls with Robbie Hitterman or Gavin Levy, or especially having Liam out here with us these last couple of days on the field. It's been immense. Liam brings an amazing commitment, drive, and passion, and he's treating our players like they were part of his own academy. I really envy his dedication to Scottish football, to Aberdeen Football Club, and the development of his players. It is equally exemplary as it is infectious.
The Aberdeen FC Youth Academy has been doing the club proud in Europe earlier this month, taking on some of the biggest sides on the continent as teams from three different age groups travel to the Netherlands, Germany and Norway. The 2008 and 2009 age group are European champions after beating Red Bull Leipzig in the final, winning 5-4 on penalties in the Flint Mikasa Cup. The 2010s were in Germany, competing in the Finks Cup, finishing in the fifth place in the tournament. And the 2011 group travelled to the Netherlands to take part in the Jorrit Hendricks tournament, where they finished third, reaching the semi-final stage and narrowly losing out to Borussia Mönchengladbach 1-0 before beating AZ Alkmaar 2-1 in the third and fourth round playoff. Here is Gavin Levy on their success.
Achievement that those boys have had this week in Norway, it probably emulates everything that we've had across all the age groups. And we've had a lot of good things this weekend, but for them to go out and even hold their own in terms of penalties against Red Bull Leipzig and score all five penalties, because the preparation went in here out on those pitches last week, was something else. We've got a young player, Joseph Teasdale, who hardly played football throughout lockdown and afterwards, just going through a tough time with some injuries. He was the guy who stepped up and scored that winning penalty. And when I seen those scenes last night on the TV, when he ran into the crowd and all those fans from Norway that have become Aberdeen fans just surrounded him, that's a massive moment. People don't realise the kind of work that goes on behind and some of the struggles that go on behind the scenes to get those special moments. So they've done terrific, and full credit to the coaching team that were there and of course, all the young players.
The SPFL released the fixtures for next season. Our opening fixture will be away against Celtic on Sunday the 31st of July. That match will also be shown live on Sky Sports. In August, we face St Mirren at home on the 6th, Motherwell at home on the 13th, St Johnstone away on the 20th and Livingston at home on the 27th. The Premiership will break for the 2022 World Cup in Qatar after fixture round 16 on November the 12th, where we'll face Dundee United at home, resuming on December the 17th against Celtic, also at home, and finishing on the weekend of May the 27th and 28th. That's the league will finish on the weekend of May the 27th and 28th, 2023. The other divisions will play through the World Cup period. Over the Christmas period, Aberdeen will face St Mirren away on Christmas Eve, Kilmarnock away on Wednesday the 28th of December, and the New Year match will be against Ross County at home on Monday the 2nd of January. Mal got the reaction from Jim Goodwin on the fixtures.
Have you had a chance to study the rest of the fixtures and how they've come out?
Yeah, I mean, we've looked at them all, obviously, this morning and tried to study them and see, those opening half a dozen fixtures are the ones that you look for initially. Celtic is a tough game, but we're not going to go there and be defeatist about it. We're going to go there and hopefully be in good form coming off the back of a good League Cup campaign and feeling good about ourselves. That is the plan. And then we've got a decent run of fixtures thereafter to really get our teeth stuck into. So those are the first fixtures that you look for, and then obviously you start to look towards Christmas time and where are we going to be. Obviously the new year, some big games to look forward to then as well. It's going to be a little bit strange, I think, with the month's break in the middle of the season for the World Cup, but listen, it's exciting times, and it makes it all a bit more real now that we're back for pre-season and those fixtures are out.
You can download and subscribe to our auto-updating fixture list for the coming season for your smartphone, tablet or computer. Just head over to invernessreds.co.uk/fixtures.
Good evening. I'm speaking to you from GCHQ, the government's communications headquarters. This is because what I have to tell you is of extreme importance. Our nation is under threat of imminent cyber attack. We have reason to believe this attack by an as yet unidentified foreign power will be far more damaging and wide-ranging than anything we have seen before. We must all immediately prepare ourselves for the impact of this invisible strike. I'll hand over now to Daniel Patrick from the cyber defense team here at GCHQ.
Thank you, Prime Minister. In a cyber attack, everything connected to the internet can be turned against us. So whilst this attack will not immediately harm us physically, it could dismantle our very way of life. Our critical infrastructure is vulnerable. Basic energy supplies, water reserves, transport systems, and in particular our communications, the internet, mobile phone networks, and TV broadcasts may be targeted. Our defenses are strong, but we must expect a significant impact on how we live. Imminently.
Your safety is this government's absolute priority. Our cyber task force is on standby and ready to counter this attack, but there is no doubt that the hours, days, and weeks ahead will be challenging. Please do not panic buy food. Rations will be allocated if necessary. Above all, remain calm.
Just shortly after the end of last season, Graham Hunter spoke to Jim Goodwin in an extended interview where they discussed the new campaign, summer recruitment, and more.
Jim, how on earth did you get persuaded to spend time with me? Thank you very much. This is our first time of meeting. I'm really glad to meet you. I've enjoyed listening to you from Spain, from afar.
Thank you.
I think you're our 26th permanent manager in history, which is not bad for a club that started in 1903, but you're our first Irishman. So forgive me, the maybe yours was football all the way or GAA in Munster. Is it Tramore or Tramore?
Tramore.
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 Down by the sea, a resort and a...
Very similar to where we are now, actually, Aberdeen, yeah.
Right by any warmer?
Slightly, not much in it.
I bet it is. But before your time, I was first aware of Munster, which is your province, your region in Ireland, because of Tony Ward and Munster defeating the All Blacks, all conquering All Blacks. And from then on, I've spent a lot of time in Ireland. And, you know, if you watch things at Thomond Park, I can't speak for the footballers, I can't speak for the GAA. But I have a pretty clear idea of what a Munster man brings to sport. Tell me what a Munster man brings to sport and whether you fit into that template.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, you mentioned Munster. You know, we are a big rugby province and I'm very proud of that. And I watch a lot of the Heineken rugby. Munster have done great in recent years. And it's always a good day out whenever I get time to go back home and go and watch some of the big events. But we're very much a GAA town where I come from as well. So I grew up playing Gaelic football and hurling, which is similar to Shinty, which you guys have got here. And obviously soccer was a big part of my life growing up. But we tried to pretty much juggle the weekends with always playing soccer on a Saturday, then sometimes playing Gaelic football in the afternoon. And then when I went to secondary school, I ended up going to a rugby school, actually, in the secondary school. So I got involved in the rugby as well.
Where did you play? What were you?
I was number 10. I was the kicker.
Not just the kicker. This is the man, this is Del Piero of rugby, right?
Well, I don't know. I think I was just trying to keep myself out of those rucks and having people standing all over my head. But yeah, I mean, look, I grew up playing a lot of physical sport and I probably put that down to part of the reason why I played soccer in the manner and watch in what I did. You often see that with a lot of young Irish footballers who have always either played Gaelic football or hurling. Anybody who watches the games, they're on Sky now, will see what a physical sport they are. Yeah, and pretty much anything goes. So trying to separate that as a young kid when you go to play soccer can sometimes they can you become a little bit mixed. But it was a great upbringing. I loved the town where I'm from in Ireland, in County Waterford. As I said, similar kind of seaside town to what Aberdeen is. I had a great upbringing. Spent most of my life on the beach or playing sports somewhere. Some cracking golf courses there, similar to Aberdeen as well. And yeah, I couldn't fault the childhood that I had, really.
But I mean, anytime you try to make cultural assumptions from seeing a team play, you might be extrapolating too much, but I feel that in Munster, there's either innate or it's taught and handed down a ferocity of character and a ferocity towards competing in all sports.
Well, listen, I think that desire and that willingness to win and that competitive edge, I think to be an athlete at any level nowadays, you've got to have that. But I think coming from where I come from, down the country in Ireland, you know, where, yeah, I mean, we're used to getting stuck in, I think it's fair to say, you know, and obviously that kind of persona has followed me throughout my playing career as a player. And it's something that I want my teams, whether I'm involved here at Aberdeen or St Mirren previously or Alloa prior to that, I want my team to have that kind of grit and that determination first and foremost. I think, you know, we're all football fans of one club or another. And when I was growing up, and even now, you know, I'm a big Liverpool fan. And when I watch Liverpool playing with my wee boy, you know, there's nothing better than seeing a committed team performance and somebody going into a 50-50 challenge like their life depends on it, you know.
Every time.
And that never say die attitude, you know, whether you're 1-0 down or 2-0 down with 10 minutes to go, that willingness to keep going right till the end. And yeah, I want to see that in my Aberdeen team here next season and for the seasons to follow after that.
So that was my first understanding of Munster and whatever. And let it be clear, I was talking with admiration about what I saw in Munster Sports, genuine admiration. What did you... this interview isn't going to be too nebulous. You know, this is our manager. There are key questions to talk about in terms of what's gone by this season and what lies ahead. But if you look back and think about watching Liverpool as a youngster, watching that very dominant Liverpool side as you were growing up, okay, they were coming towards, by the time you're 7, 8, that era where they stopped winning leagues. Mm-hmm. But you see their videos, you're handed the legends, you're old enough to be watching when Kenny's the manager at Liverpool and wins a double, or when you're growing up and watching lots of Celtic. What influences now would you judge that watching as a youngster the two teams that you preferred gave you, or things built into your character?
I think that Liverpool team in the 80s, even now when I watch stuff back, and my wee boy James is 9 years old and he's Liverpool daft, and we're both going to put up the red bunting and the flags tomorrow night at the house. We've got family coming around to watch the game against Real Madrid, and we've got our fingers and toes crossed for a positive outcome of that one, or the wee man will be in tears, no doubt. But yeah, I mean, even when I try and show him some of the stuff on YouTube and what have you of that Liverpool team in the 80s, you know, they played some fantastic football. Yes, the game has obviously improved and sports science has played a big part, but there's no getting away from the talent, the individual talent and the collective talent within that group of players. You know, Kenny Dalglish, you speak about, you know, one of the greatest Scottish players of all time and one of the best players probably ever to play the game. You know, when people talk about George Best and Pelés and Maradonas, Dalglish has got to be up there when you're talking about those top players. So, yeah, I think they had a little bit of everything. They had a really good back line. They had fullbacks that would bomb on and join in. They had midfielders with great energy, and they had guys at the top of the pitch that could entertain. And, yeah, I think, you know, although it was 30, 40 years ago now nearly, I think we're all still trying to emulate that. And I still think you see glimpses of that Liverpool team in the 80s in this one now that Jurgen Klopp has built.
Let's segue then, before we go into recruitment and your analysis of where we're at with the squad and what we need to do. That Jim Goodwin team that you're describing, let's not talk about names, but do you have a philosophy that's clear in terms of would you choose 4-4-2, 4-3-3 only dependent on the players that you've got? Or do you have basic concepts that you like a structure, you say, I know how that will work? And secondly, whatever the structure, whatever the layout is, are you somebody who wants to wait and play on the counter, or preference? Would you like to be intense and winning the ball back high and, you know, a high defensive line? If you were to break down Jim Goodwin's preferred philosophy of how a team of yours would play, what are the things you would describe?
Well, I want to play with a back four. There's no doubt about that. I think we can fluctuate between playing a 4-3-3 and a 4-2-3-1 depending on opposition. And that's something that we'll work on during pre-season with the players. And we'll try and bed those two different systems in. I want to play a high line at the back. To do that, you need pace in the team. You need energy. I want my fullbacks to be very expansive and, you know, willing to join in and get forward. And yeah, I mean, the players that play in our team need to be able to handle the ball, because we want to be a possession-based team that builds from the back. But there needs to be an urgency to it, you know, and I hate watching teams, and it's happened to us on a few occasions. Even I think back to the game at McDermott Park. It was a really boring, dull game of football because we had plenty of possession of the ball, 70%, I believe, on the night. But too much of it was side to side.
You never want it to be sterile, do you?
We need to be able to penetrate the opposition, but we also need to be able to mix the game up. It's all well and good me sitting here saying I want to play this way and that way. Every now and again, you need to put a ball in behind. Yep. You need to play a diagonal ball. But to do that, you need to have pace and you need to have energy in the team. So that's the messages that we'll be giving across to the players during pre-season, and hopefully that will come into fruition when we start up in the first competitive game on the 9th of July.
When you're talking about having the ball, generally, I'm not talking about this squad yet. When you're talking about being good in possession and a high line and forcing the other team back and asking them questions, players need to accept risk, because that pass that makes the difference between boring possession or sterile possession has to accept that the player knows that the right type of risk is acceptable to the coaching team, and he's not going to get a bollock in just because he tried to put the ball between two opponents because there was a ball. How do you, because you don't want stupid passes either, but how do you stand as the leader of your squad on that concept of risk?
I think that's a great point, and I always say that, particularly to the players at the top end of the pitch, in the final third in particular. We want the lads at the back to be brave. We want our goalkeeper to play out from the back. But then when teams come and lock on high up the pitch, then we need to be able to come up with other solutions. Can we drop it over the opposition's defensive midfielders into the striker's chest to then get support and runners off it? Those kind of things. Again, all patterns of play that we will work on during pre-season, on our tour or here at Cormac Park or wherever. And we'll bed those ideas in. So we want the players to have that freedom to be able to decide what works at that particular moment. I don't want them to be robotic. I don't want them, the manager says we have to do it this way, so this is the way we have to do it. If they see something on the day, then they have to be allowed the freedom to go and try that. At the top end of the pitch, we always encourage the players to try something. You know, if it's wide players in 1v1s, I don't want the wide player to lose the ball in 2v1s and then think, the manager might give me a little bit of trouble here if I try it again. You know, I know you've seen plenty of Leo Messi during your time watching La Liga, and statistically there's not a player in the world who gives the ball away more.
Always he's top of the rankings, of course he is.
Now, if Lionel Messi was brought up in a generation or at a club where he was criticised for trying these difficult passes, then he probably would become inverted and maybe go into his shell and maybe think, I better not try that. So we don't want to knock the confidence of the players. Don't get me wrong, if one of my centre-halves tries to nutmeg a striker on our own 18-yard line and they score, then of course
there might be a discussion afterwards.
That's a different situation. But at the top end of the pitch, we want our midfielders, our fullbacks, our attacking-minded players to have that self-belief, that courage, I think, is a really big word, and that bravery to go and try those passes, because it's easy. You know, I could play in the middle of the pitch myself if all we had to do was go side to side all the time. You know, we want the players to have that freedom to go and play a clever pass in behind. But to do that, you also need the options off the ball. You need runners off the ball. So trying to get all of that to come together is what pre-season is all about.
Three quick things come straight off what you've said. One, my perception from the majority only watching from afar rather than being able to be at Pittodrie is that Bates, so long as he has a future at this club, is better at right centre-back. And I feel that we need a left-footed centre-back. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair comment?
Absolutely. I kind of felt for David Bates a lot because I've done it myself during my career and even at the latter stages of my time at St Mirren. I found myself playing left centre half as a naturally right-footed player. Obviously, when the manager asks you to play, you play anywhere. But it is a disadvantage. There's no doubt about it, because instead of turning out naturally to play a ball up the line, you're always coming back inside onto your favoured right foot, which eventually ends up where all the trouble is. So I do feel for players that play out of position. And I think that is only fair to say that David Bates has been playing out of position most of the season. We do need a natural left-sided centre-half, and that's something that we are working on. And I think we're very close to getting a really good one over the line, if not by the end of this week, hopefully early part of next week. And once we get everything finalised, that will be announced, and I think that's one that supporters will be excited about. But I think it's really important. You know, I know we'll come on to the recruitment again, but when we are recruiting, it's really important that we get a good balance in the team. You know, and I feel as if we've had a lot of right footers in the team last season. No real balance in the back line, no real balance at the top end of the pitch, you know, all right-footed players. So we need to try and do something about that if we can as well.
You said another thing that I want to pick up on, because, you know, that whatever, it's 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3, if there's a two in the middle and screening the defence, one of them will probably be the more creative, probably the other will be more defensive. That's a balance. If there's a 4-3-3, then managers have got a big choice about who the guy in the middle is. Is he there as a screen?
Yeah.
I don't like the phrase holding role because that's very mono. It's just one idea. Whereas you would never call Sergio Busquets, for example, a holding player because his ability to initiate short, clever passes into... Yeah. You played, I think not everybody remembers that you did play a decent chunk of your career in central midfield as well as at centre back. Conor Barron is a different shape, a different physique, and a different age from you, coming from a different era. But he excites me a huge amount because of his give me the ball. There are several types of bravery, and he has it in spades as well as vision and movement and a low centre of balance. And he's 19, so I promise not to mention future Ballon d'Or awards and that kind of stuff, although I just did. But isn't that the type of bravery and movement in space that we want to see? And are you enthused by what you've seen of him since he came back from Kelty?
Without a doubt, yeah. And I mean, look, he's not one that I can take a great deal of credit for. You know, I've just kept him in the team. You know, and Stephen Glass was the one that brought him back from Kelty at the time, recognised something in him. He was having a great first half of the season at Kelty. And yeah, I mean, he's went from strength to strength, it's fair to say. Yeah, and that is something. You know, when you talk about bravery, people would maybe think about someone going to put their head in where it hurts or going to go into those 50-50 tackles. Bravery for me is in a hostile environment, you know, in a stadium like, let's say, Parkhead or Ibrox, where there's 60,000 people there, having the courage to still take the ball, even though we're under pressure, even though there might be a man very tight to you, still showing for it, still demanding it off the centre-backs and off the full-backs. And Conor does that. He plays with no fear. But we encourage him to do that. We don't, you know, if he gives it away once or twice, the last thing I want him to do is then, you know, disengage and go away from where the ball is. We still want him to go and get on it. Conor is also capable of playing a little bit further forward. He's got great balance. He takes it on the half turn. He's always willing to go and drive at people. And people think that you've got to have wingers that can do well in 1v1 situations. Something I don't think we have had since I've came in is people in the middle of the pitch that will take the ball in the half turn and go and commit midfielders and drive by midfielders. And that's something that Conor does really well in training. But we have had to play him a little bit deeper because he's the one, for me, that has got that courage that we speak about to come and get on the ball. I do think it's really important to remind ourselves that he is only 19. He has only had, you know, a handful of games in the first team from the turn of the year. He is a big, big part of our plans. But we are looking to strengthen in that area of the pitch as well because we don't want Conor thinking he's a mainstay now. We want Conor to think, well, if I drop my standards,
competition
then I'm
going
to be out of the team. And I don't think we've had enough of that this year. And that's something, again, where the recruitment is so important. There shouldn't be anybody in the team, whether it's the goalkeeper or whether it's the main number nine, there shouldn't be a single player in the team that thinks, well, doesn't really matter what I do here today because I'm going to be playing again next week.
Well, you were right. I was coming to the way in which, in the interview that I did with Dave Cormack, he talked about specifically wanting, even before your appointment, and not achieving it before Stephen's appointment, to change the way in which the club recruited. So, number one, appointing Darren Mowbray, Tony's brother. And two, promoting Stephen Gunn into a role which might be similar to what he was doing before, but now has broader responsibility. But it's clear that we spoke before we started recording that your background as a player, where you played, the people you played with, but also how you were part of recruitment at St Mirren indicates that not only do you, as the coach, the manager, have a final say about, like, well, yeah, I said I wanted this type of player, but actually, from what I'm seeing, that's not the guy I meant. So you have a big voice in that, but presumably you need an integrated role in the beginning of the process too. So describe the way you think that the recruitment process will work at Aberdeen, and what are your relationships with Darren and Stephen?
Well, I have to say, when I first came in to Aberdeen, I was delighted to see what was already in place, you know, because for me, a club like Aberdeen should have the kind of recruitment policy that it has now, but it didn't have previously. And that's no disrespect to, you know, any previous managers that were here. You know, Derek McInnes comes to mind. Derek had his way of doing things. He was very much in control of the recruitment. He had his own chief scout, and Derek had great success off the back of that. So we can't deny that. But for me, in the modern day game, for a club the size of Aberdeen, you should have a director of football. You should have a head of recruitment. That head of recruitment should have an army of scouts underneath him, not just, you know, spanning the length and breadth of the British Isles, but Europe and worldwide, because that's the size of club we are. And, you know, we spoke prior to coming on air about, you know, lazy recruitment. It's very easy to sign players from teams that you play against in your own league and maybe pick the best player here and there. I'm not saying we'll never do that, because sometimes that's worthwhile. But we have to be willing to go to Europe, maybe go to South America, maybe go...
I'm going to throw in Ireland as well.
Well, Ireland has been great for me during my time at St Mirren. There's no doubt about that.
The last time this club lifted a trophy, we'd run a flood, and Adam Rooney and Johnny.
Yeah, and Niall McGinn. And so look, I mean, we have to broaden our horizons. There's no doubt about that. And that is something that we're really working hard on. When I came in February, obviously, I've got a different idea to maybe the previous manager. I've got a different profile of player that we're looking for. So the first week I sat down with Stephen Gunn and with Darren Mowbray, and I gave them exactly the profile of player that I want for goalkeeper, centre-back, full-back, midfielder, striker, winger.
Without being cheeky, you're breaking your flow. I think for the fans who are buying Aberdeen DNA and season tickets, when you made those guidelines for them and you said the profile... Was it a technical profile? Was it a physical profile? How would you, without naming names, obviously, what were you specifically saying? When I want this type of right back, I want this type of centre half.
Well, I mean, it's everything you would, you know, people would be blown away, I think, by the level of detail now that clubs go into in terms of that research and into the recruitment side of things, because it's not just about the ability of the player. You know, we can all see on the telly or whether it's live in a game, they're good technical players, they've got good ability, but then we need to find out a little bit more about their character and about their background and social life and all of this kind of stuff, which you would expect, because it is huge investments. You know, sometimes you're paying hundreds of thousands for these players, sometimes you're giving them similar amounts in salaries, and if you were doing that in any other industry, you would want to make sure you're getting it right.
The phrase due diligence is used a lot, but due diligence means exactly what you've talked about, taking a magnifying glass to every discoverable part of a talented player's background to say, is he what we want?
Yeah, exactly. And those are the discussions that myself and Darren and Stephen will have on a regular basis. But in terms of the profile of the player, I want a team full of athletes first and foremost, right? So, you know, I no interest in players who are overweight, no interest in players who, you know, lack professionalism. For me, I keep talking about it all the time to even the players that are here now or even the guys that I had at St Mirren. You know, I made a career out of being fit. I'm not trying to be modest here. Anybody who's watched me playing over the years will know I wasn't in the team for my technical ability or for my goals or creativity or anything like that.
Champion of Europe with your country.
No, but I was a fit player, and I think it's the easiest thing in the world for anyone to, especially the level that we're at, is to look after the diet and to train properly and to work hard and to be professional away from the training ground. You know, they've got all the help that they need nowadays. The kids growing up in football now have got an unbelievable education with the sports scientists who are involved. So there are no excuses for going away on holidays during the closed season and coming back a stone overweight. You know, the lads who are here now know that that won't be accepted. They've all got their programs. They'll be working hard. And when they come back on the day one of pre-season, it's not, let's spend the first 2 weeks trying to lose half a stone. It's day one, we're working hard and we're preparing for that first competitive game on the 9th of July.
As a group, were we fit enough for your taste when you took over and by the time the season ended?
See, it's always a difficult one to answer because Stephen Glass, who I like, and I wouldn't say we're great pals or anything like that, but in the dealings that I've had with him, I've got nothing but respect for him. But yeah, I mean, for me, I wanted the boys to be fitter. I always think we can be fitter. World records in athletics are broken year on year on year because people keep pushing themselves. So I don't think we can ever get to a level and just plateau and be happy. How do we continue to drive that line up the way?
I'm being tempted because this is a club interview and you're the manager and you have to work with these men. Mm-hmm. But I was less referring to Stephen and his staff than, and this is a theme, I think, than the way in which the players think and react and act individually and a group. My perspective from afar is that you're involved in culture change, leaving aside mm-hmm. the players that you and Stephen and the board, the chairman and Darren will sign. I think there's a culture change needed.
Well, I think the manager needs to be involved. The head of any organisation needs to be involved in what the culture is at the club, and there's no getting away from that. The standards daily at Cormac Park are extremely high, as you would imagine. There's so many great people behind the scenes making sure that Cormac Park runs smoothly, from the guys in the catering, the cleaners, the kit man, you name it. All the people out with the football team are all doing their jobs impeccably. It's now up to us on the football side of things to make sure we get the results on the park to reflect all of that hard work. But yeah, I mean, look, standards are a big thing for me. You know, I don't get me wrong, we're not running a military camp or anything like that. You know, we want the guys to come into work in the morning and be excited to come into work because it's a great facility. They get well looked after. We wanted them to enjoy the environment without a shadow of a doubt. But when we're working hard and there's no messing about. You know, if we're asking them to do an exercise, then do it to the best of your ability. And that's where, you know, it gets back to, okay, the buck stops with the manager. I accept that. You know, if performances aren't what they need to be or results aren't right, I'll be the one to lose my job. Totally get that. But everybody needs to take responsibility for what their role in the football club is.
I suspect some on the training ground didn't, Jim.
But this is what I'm saying, and this is where it comes down to my backroom team and to the players as well. Just do the job you're being asked to do to the best of your ability. And if you're a player, then that is to be a role model, to be a top professional, to be in the best condition that you can possibly be in, to give yourself the best chance to perform at the highest level possible. And I have to say, the majority of the group are like that. There's some really top pros within the group. The ones who maybe aren't, then you won't be surprised that they probably won't be here at the start of next season.
You see, you startled me, and you did something that obviously most fans of our club don't want to hear again for 10 years, never mind 10 months, but most fans like to hear the honesty that you used after St Johnstone. But as I listened to the interview, I found it startling because you used a phrase, and I'm sorry if it's a paraphrase, but I think it's reasonable, you know, a group of players whose performance had already lost one good coach his job. And when you say on the touchline that after a defeat, that always tells me that if the manager is in a decent position of power and you're just in the door, and that's when you're at your most powerful, is the word I want to use. But when you use words like that and you're articulate and bright as you are, then it's deliberate. And those are stinging words for players to hear. And you'd obviously reached a point that night where you were like, I'm drawing a line right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's certain things. I'll always do my best to be as open and as honest as what I can be in terms of post-match interviews. Obviously, there's certain things that need to stay within the confines of the dressing room. I will never, throw anyone under the bus in terms of if a centre-back makes a mistake, we'll not point the finger at him or the goalkeeper, or if a striker misses an opportunity. We are all in it together. There's no doubt about that. But the point I was making after the St Johnstone game was not something that I just came out of the dressing room and said to you guys on Red TV. I said it to the guys in the dressing room after the game as well. Yeah. And that's where I talk about responsibility and accountability, right? Because I know how much other people within this club are putting into it. And I know how desperate they are for success. And the group of players that we bring to the club need to have that same mindset. They need to have the hunger and the ambition and that willingness to be as successful as the rest of us want to be. If it doesn't matter enough to them, then I don't want them here. And that's the point I'm trying to make. So, yes, the manager will feel the brunt of it. And people say, oh, well, you know, you need to be able to motivate them. You need to be able to do this. My mistake, possibly, was being too honest with the players when I first came in about who's getting kept on and who's not getting kept on. And that's something that's been thrown back at me on a few occasions. But I stand by what I did because I felt I was talking to grown men who deserved the right to know what my plans for them were. If someone comes into my office and bangs my door and asks for a conversation about what the future holds for them, I'm not going to look him in the eye and say, oh, well, you know, not made my mind up yet. Come back and see me in 2 months.
In other words, lie. You know,
lie.
Which the football industry is full of people who do that for a living and will sit there and smile and pat in the back and then at the end of the season, no, I've changed my mind.
Because as soon as that player leaves my office, he knows I don't fancy him anyway.
Yeah.
So me trying to kick the can down the road for 2 months in the hope that the player is going to still perform, it doesn't work like that. I have always respected the managers the most in my career who have been upfront and honest with me, good, bad or indifferent. You know, whether I had a good game, a bad game, whether they fancied me as a player or they didn't, I always shook their hand and thought, well, thanks very much for being honest. And there's not enough of that in this
game. When I moved to Barcelona, Juan Román Riquelme, who was a reasonable player and might fit in everybody's plans these days, was booted out by Louis van Gaal. And Louis van Gaal went straight to him and said, you're not my type of player.
Yeah.
You can't play in my system.
Yeah.
And Riquelme went off to Villarreal and went to a Champions League semi-final and became maybe the greatest player in their history. And Riquelme, a contrary and aggressive Argentinian, always said exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
Van Gaal told me straight, and I appreciated that.
Yeah.
And I hear a phrase that you used 4 minutes ago saying that you thought you were dealing with grown men who would like to be told the truth.
Yeah, well...
That's quite a damning phrase.
I asked a number of the individuals that, you know, if they were willing to show a good level of professionalism, continue to work hard and train, and if I needed them at a certain point, then I know I could trust them when I stick them in. And unfortunately, one or two couldn't handle what I had told them, and that's what happens. You know, I think back to my time at Huddersfield when Stan Ternent, who, an old English manager, great character within the game, signed me on a 3-year contract in the July. Stan lost his job, I think it was around about the September. Lee Clark came in the September. I had a little under 3 years left on a really decent contract. And he told me from day one, look, you're free to leave. And I said, well, I'm not going to go anywhere and get this kind of contract again. So what do you want to do? And he said, well, if you're here, you knuckle down, you keep the professionalism, and if I need you, I'll use you. I said, that'll do for me. I said, I'll try and prove you wrong. And I played 34 games for him that season. Now, don't get me wrong, the end of the season, he told me the same thing again. Listen, there's going to be changes, you're free to go. But I just always respected him for that. And I thought, you know, good on you. At least you've got the courage to tell me, as opposed to, you know, avoiding each other in the corridor and me thinking, does he fancy me, does he not? Let's just be honest with each other. And I think that's the best way, and you talk about culture early on, that's the kind of environment that I want, where we can all sit as a group, the team and my staff, and we can be open and honest with each other. And they might come back at me and say, well, Gaffer, I don't agree with this, I don't agree with that. We can discuss it. I can try and explain to them why I want to do it that way. I might take certain things that they say on board and think, well, okay, well, maybe that's not working. We can tweak it. Obviously, I'll have the final say on what way we're going to go with things. But I think in modern day society, I think people want to be involved in what's happening, and I think they respect the honesty more than not.
Just for the record, I don't know, Chris, where my camera is, but it's there. My opinion is a millionth of the importance of the managers, but for those who criticised exactly what Jim's talking about, how did Alex Ferguson handle subjects like that? Direct, brutal honesty. So I think for those who have been throwing it back at you, as you say, or criticising you, my stance is very clear that that's the right way to manage. And those that can't handle it, like, I could have handled it. It's how I live my life. Yeah. And I think Aberdonians and North East people, we're supposed to be pretty frank and to the point.
Yeah, so, and I think the problem as well that we had at that particular moment was, you know, I inherited a squad which had, I think, 11 over 30-year-olds. And I don't think that's healthy anyway for a club of this size to have that amount of over 30s. So I think as well, when you're having those conversations with grown men who are thinking, well, where do I go from here? Then, you know, maybe their reaction is one of disappointment. Maybe there's that arrogance as well that you think, well, you know, I am good enough to still play for this club. The point I'm trying to make is we won't find ourselves in that position again where 8 or 9 players are being told in February that they're not getting kept on. Because if we do the recruitment properly and we're always in advance of those situations, we would be able to move certain ones out in January, bring fresh faces in. We might only have 3 or 4 players out of contract in the summer. So those conversations become easier because it's less volume of players. The problem we had when I came in, I had a squad of maybe 11 or 12 that I knew weren't part of my plans long term. And unfortunately, most of them were the wrong side of 30. So they're very opinionated characters, if you like. And that's to be expected, I think.
We will accelerate because you've got a Liverpool fanatic goalkeeper waiting for you, and your time is valuable, and so is the summertime. But there are 3 key subjects that I need to touch on yet, and one of them is absolutely vital: the academy. Mm-hmm. You buy into the concept that a healthy academy needs its best players being given time in the first team in order to cut their teeth, in order to learn. But also in order to, you know, that 83 side, because those outside the club who want to hammer us, stuck in the 80s, Alex Ferguson era. Okay, in managerial terms, Alex Ferguson was a genius, the best there is. Yeah. But that team was full of players who were given their chance, who maybe took a little bit of time to prove themselves. A lot of Aberdonians, a lot who'd come through what was our youth system then. And in clutch situations, that really helped us. Because not all of them were world talents, but their mentality and how they'd been brought up and what they believed and what the club meant to them was crucial. So I'm asking straight, you know, I think our academy is very healthy. I think Gav Levy does extraordinary work. There's now Cormac Park. Where do you stand on using Aberdeen's academy, and how will you try to do that?
Well, I came to Aberdeen from St Mirren, who are also a club who rely heavily on that pathway from the academy into the first team. So during my time at St Mirren, I think I gave 5, possibly 6 young players their debuts. It is something that I want to be recognised for as a young coach as well, developing kids, giving them an opportunity. I think the investment that the chairman and the rest of the board have made in Cormac Park, I think would be worthless if we weren't willing to continue to develop our own. And the guys within the academy are doing a great job. We've got a number of our younger players away involved with Scotland and on the international tournaments, right from under 15, 16s, all the way up into the national team now with young Lewis. We've already done it. You know, young Liam Harvey obviously making his debut in the last couple of games of the season, which was great. We've got 2 or 3 more coming behind that. Obviously, Calvin Ramsey is the one, I suppose, that sticks out most for people. Jack McKenzie is involved regularly. Connor Barron, we've spoke about, involved regularly. So, yeah, we want to continue to develop our own, and we want to have, we get back to talking about that balance that we spoke about, where you've got good experienced players who are role models and good professionals, and the likes of Johnny Hayes, who I think is a terrific guy for the younger players to look up to. Johnny's 34, nearly 35, still one of the fittest in the team, still one of the quickest in the team.
His times in training prove that, don't they?
When we do any of the testing, you know, Johnny's times are right up there, right at the top of the tree. So, you know, a good example of a senior player who looks after himself, who trains properly, lives his life properly, and therefore can have longevity in his playing career. And Johnny's got another couple of years at least left in him playing at this level. But he's a great example to your Calvin Ramseys and Jack McKenzies of the world. So, yeah, for the football club to be sustainable, you know, we can't keep going to, you know, Dave Cormack and to the rest of the board and asking them to pump millions of their own money in. You know, we have to make the football club sustainable. The best clubs in the world are run by, you know, selling players, by profits, by season ticket sales, commercially as well. And the commercial team are doing great things there with Rob Wicks behind the scenes. So, as I said earlier, all the other departments are doing really, really well. The academy is doing really, really well. The first team this last season has been a major disappointment, but we will get it back. There is no doubt in my mind with the changes that we're making across the board, we will be competing at the top end of the table next season. It's all easy for me to say that here. Supporters watching this will be thinking, well, talk is cheap. We need to see the action. Totally get that. But every club all over the world, you know, big or small, have transition periods. You know, Barcelona went through it. Man United are still going through it. We had it this year. We've had a disappointing season. But, you know, it's not dead and buried. We're capable, because of the amount of players that are leaving, we're capable of making great changes in the summer, which are going to get us back to where we want to be.
I don't think talk is cheap when, you know, when you're laying out ideas and philosophies and you're giving fans who have to travel, who have to invest in season tickets or Aberdeen DNA, mm-hmm. whatever it might be, I think they require to go, I hear that, I hear his ideas, I trust, I'm wary, or some might say talk is cheap, but I think that what you're laying down is something that people can go away now and chew and think and share and discuss over a pint or whatever it might be, mm-hmm. or discuss with their kids. How many thousand kids have we now got in Aberdeen DNA? 7,000 coming in mm-hmm. in the next couple of days too.
Yeah.
But you're good at this because you segued exactly to my second last point. Without being a cheerleader for him, I am both interested in and convinced by Dave Cormack, because mm-hmm. what I see is clarity of ideas. I see, you said something that I don't know why in this neck of the world people forget really quickly. He's put his money in.
Mm-hmm.
He's
Absolutely.
Invested in the club that he loves, which if I'd done well commercially in life, I would do. I think he's accepted where he's maybe erred or things haven't come off as well as possible. But for my personal taste, without being defensive of him, I think he's a little bit misunderstood and a little bit underappreciated. Now, clearly, if we finish just above the relegation zone, that feeling might perpetuate a little bit. But describe the man you know and what your relationship is with the chairman.
Listen, I don't think anybody watching this would expect me to come on here and say anything negative about the chairman. But all I can say is be honest, as we were talking about earlier. The relationship that we're building, and we're still at that very early stage of it, is a really strong one, a really positive one. I've been involved with clubs in the past where chairmen want to run things from top to bottom, but don't actually invest in it. You know, their own personal wealth. You know, Mr. Cormack has put millions of his own money in to make his team better. You know, he could have stayed over in America and invested in one of these MLS teams if he wanted to, but his allegiances are here to Aberdeen, to the city, to the football club, and he wants to give the people of Aberdeen, I think, a team that they can be proud of. Yes, he has held his hands up, and I think you've got to admire him for that, for one or two mistakes that he's possibly made, but he's determined to put it right. There's no doubt about that. I think myself and him have both got very similar characteristics in terms of, you know, we want everything done yesterday. I think we both lack a bit of patience.
Quite forthright too.
Yeah, I think we both lack a bit of patience. But I think, you know, when I get back to talking about accountability and people taking responsibility for their roles and things, I think the chairman has done that. You know,
yeah, I agree.
And he's out there with the fans. There's a lot of clubs I've been at in the past where supporters are forever criticising the club for not being transparent enough and not having enough dialogue with supporters. There's nobody could label that at the chairman. I mean, he's involved in all these different supporters groups all of the time, inviting different groups to the stadium here on match day to sit down and talk to him and give him his ideas.
And listening, I think, is something which not all powerful men do. My impression when I hear what he says from these forums that he goes to is that, he's trying to explain and listen and convince.
Yeah.
But I believe he's also soaking up what those people he meets want him to hear.
Yeah, and he's a top, top businessman. There is no getting away from that. You can't have the success that he's had in the business world in America, you know, if you're not highly intelligent and quite driven. And, he's used to being successful. And I've got absolutely no doubt in my mind that he'll bring success to Aberdeen. And some of the things that have already happened that the fans don't really get to see. I mean, we speak about the recruitment. It was, you know, Dave Cormack and that it promoted Stephen Gunn in the director of football role, which is a position a club like Aberdeen should have. It was Dave Cormack that decided to, you know, restructure the recruitment along with Stephen Gunn, bringing in Darren Mowbray, who, I was a little bit apprehensive about meeting initially because I'm thinking this guy's just new in. If I don't like him or can't build a relationship with him, then that's something we're going to have to change. But thankfully...
absolutely spot on.
But thankfully, Darren Mowbray has got a real eye for a player. We've got a similar understanding to what is needed for the team to take it forward. And, you know, Dave deserves to be congratulated for a lot of what he's done.
And being fundamentally important for Cormac Park.
Yeah, absolutely. And Rob Wicks as well. I mean, he brought Rob in, who's a top, top commercial manager who, you know, the numbers will be there for everybody to see, but the growth on the commercial side of things in the last 12 months since Rob has came in, I think it's over 30%, which again is great money coming into the club, which will help us to reinvest in the first team squad. I don't want to be sitting here blowing
smoke.
I'm
asking you a direct question and you've given a direct answer.
I don't want it to sound a little bit cheesy. The fans will be there going, oh, Jim is, you know, smoking, blowing smoke up the chairman's backside. It's not like that at all. There's no doubt me and the chairman will, from time to time in the years to come, have
sparks might fly.
A little bit of friction, and there might be disagreements along the way, but it'll all be done in the correct manner. It'll all be done because we want what's best for Aberdeen Football Club. We're not all going to see eye to eye all of the time. And me and him, because of the personalities that we are, probably will clash from time to time. We haven't up to now. I have to say, honestly, he's been an absolute pleasure. He's very, very supportive, and anything that I need that I think is going to improve things behind the scenes, he's determined to get it for us by hook or by crook. And I'm as desperate to give him back that success for having the faith and the trust to give me this opportunity of being Aberdeen manager as I am to give the supporters back a team on the park that's entertaining and worth coming to watch. So, yeah, look, there's a lot of good people behind the scenes. Dave Cormack being one of them. Stephen Gunn being another. Darren Mowbray, as I spoke about. All the guys in the media team that are here today. You know, they're all doing great things for the club. And the supporters, in fairness,
I'm coming to that. When you used to get callers on Radio 1, and everybody that knows me, which you've just done.
Yeah, but look, as I said, there's one element of the club that has not been working properly, and it's the football department. Not the academy. The academy, they're doing their bit.
Yeah.
But the first team football department, for whatever reason, hasn't quite clicked last season. But we will sort it.
Well, let's pay off on, again, you've segued exactly right. From my taste, the player of the season has been the fans. You know, it's been difficult, not from start to finish, but from quite early on in the season until now. During your time in charge, you've regularly seen 14,000 crowds at Pittodrie. You've regularly seen noisy, powerful travelling supports going with you around Scotland in pretty tough times. Apart from what we've been talking about, what have you got to say to them about them? And for those, I think we've had 7,000 season ticket renewals so far. Seeing as we're here and it's just the end of the season, not even really the beginning of proper recruitment yet, although one's coming, you say. What have you got to say to the fans? One appreciation, Jim. I genuinely think they've been, you know, tough and noisy and loyal this season.
Yeah, I mean, look, I knew Aberdeen was a big club prior to me coming in. You know, if you just said to me 5 years ago while I was manager of Alloa that I'd be sitting in this seat now, you know, representing this incredible club, then I would have probably not believed you. So there are times where, you know, I drive into Cormac Park and I have to almost pinch myself to, you know, remind myself that this is the job that I'm in. And, you know, we are all determined to give the supporter something back. And I know it all sounds a bit cheesy, but it is at the end of the day their club. You know, the manager will come and go, the chairman will come and go, but the supporters and their families will be here for generations to come and generations that have passed. So we need to give them something to be proud of, something that they want to come and invest their money in season tickets. And I was blown away by the reception that I got in my first game at Motherwell. There must have been 1,500 fans there, 2,000 possibly fans there at a time where the club was struggling. The next game was the home game here for the unveiling of the Sir Alex statue.
We played well that day.
We did play well that day and we should have won the game and it would have been a fitting tribute to Sir Alex. But the supporters, there wasn't an empty seat in the house, you know, so that tells me the fans are there. Some of them are maybe a little bit frustrated at the moment and not willing to come, but it's up to me and the players to put that right, to get them back out of their homes on a weekend so they want to come and support their local team. So all I can say is that we're all extremely grateful for what they've given up to now, especially me, because this was one of the places where I used to get booed on and booed off the park when I came up here as a St Mirren player. So the reception and the reaction that they gave to me.
Listen, you're not old enough to remember, but so did Alec Ferguson when he was here with Falkirk or Rangers. He did. And when he signed as manager, I remember all the old gens going, oh, he used to come up here and elbow Abdi and I like this boy. And he came and he did okay.
He did okay. But listen, they, you know, the supporters have got every reason to voice their concerns about last season, to be negative about what went on. There's none of us trying to put our head in the sand here
but you need them, don't you?
Of course. We accept the criticism that they give us because, you know, they care about their club, but they need to understand that we care. It matters to us as well. It matters to the players. It matters to the board of directors, and it certainly matters to me, because we've all got a bit of personal pride. We might not all be lifelong Aberdeen fans, but all I can say to them is, in whatever period of time I am here, I will give my everything to make Aberdeen a successful team again. And I want our team on the park to have that passion. And I want it to look like an Aberdeen team. I look at the people of Aberdeen as hardworking, honest people. And I think they want that from their team on the pitch on a Saturday. And I think if you've got a team of players that will die for the jersey practically, will give their all, will, you know, fully committed into 50-50 tackles and leave nothing out there. I think the supporters will get behind that. I think we're all, as I said at the beginning of the conversation, we were talking about Liverpool, we're all football fans at the end of the day, and we will all accept players making mistakes, we'll all accept losing games from time to time, as long as we see that level of commitment and that level of effort. And that 100% effort is the minimum requirement to get a jersey off of me next season. And that's what we're going to give them.
The last one and the payoff is this. It's a tougher one, but can we, should we, will we be able to retain Calvin Ramsey and Lewis Ferguson?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have the crystal ball, I'm afraid. You know, they are two players who have caught the headlines this year in what's been a difficult season. Young Calvin, his data in the first half of the season was the best of any right back in the world at one point. And people might find that hard to believe, but that's a fact in terms of his deliveries into the box and his assists for goals. It was quite incredible, actually. So he did tail off in the second half of the season. I think his head was a little bit all over the place
first
with the speculation.
Season, 18 years old. It's pardonable.
Absolutely. And physically as well, it's very demanding. Playing in the Scottish Premier League week after week is very demanding for these young lads who haven't fully developed yet either. So the speculation that's out there around Calvin and Lewis is to be expected. Mm-hmm. You know, what will be. We have got a number of different contingency plans in place. Everybody has got a valuation. You know, all I can say is we will not be selling anyone on the cheap. We don't have to. We've got great backers here financially, but at the same time, we have got a real good habit of developing players and selling them at the right time to get maximum value from them. And that is something that we want to continue. And, you know, what will be in the summer, but we'll have people lined up if that is to happen.
It's a decent answer. I feel that I'm talking to a future Ireland manager, but only once he's won us a couple of trophies and taken us into Europe. We've taken our team into Europe. Remember that? That was fun and interesting and well-spoken, Jim. Thank you.
My pleasure, Graham. Great to meet you.
Smash it.
Thank you very much.
And just before I go, we have a couple of friendlies coming up. On the 25th of June, we'll face Becky Thistle at Victoria Park for the Graham Stewart testimonial. Kickoff is at 3 p.m. And on the 6th of July, we head to Glebe Park to play Brechin City. Kickoff is at 7:45 p.m. Our League Cup campaign gets underway on Sunday, the 10th of July, against Peterhead at Balmore. The match will be shown live on Premier Sports. Kickoff at 3 p.m. Our other fixtures in the group stage are on Wednesday, the 13th of July, at home to Dumbarton. That's a 7:45 kickoff. Then on Tuesday, the 19th of July, we're away to Stirling Albion, also kickoff at 7:45. And our final fixture in the group is against Raith Rovers at home on Sunday, the 24th of July, which will also be shown live on Premier Sports. And it kicks off at 3 p.m. I'll be back with more pre-season news on Friday the 1st of July. Meantime, follow us on our social media on Facebook and Twitter using Inverness Reds, and you can get all the latest on the website at invernessreds.co.uk. Till next time, stand free.
On your phone, on your tablet, and online. This is the AFC Donscast on Friday.